This is a Data Science Channel program from the Holly Giolu Data Science Institute. Visit us at ucsd.tv/data-science to learn more about how data is shaping our future.
Welcome to another episode of Science Like Me Plus. I'm Yusu Wang, a professor at the Holly Giolu Data Science Institute at UC San Diego and director of the NSF National AI Institute, TILOS. Today, it's a real pleasure to have with me Professor Gunnar Carlson. Professor Carlson is the Anne Bill Swindles Professor of Mathematics Emeritus at Stanford University. Previously, he has also held faculty positions at several institutions, including UC San Diego, University of Chicago, and Princeton University. Professor Carlson has had a truly distinguished and wide-ranging career, spanning from pure and applied mathematics, data science, AI, education, and entrepreneurship. He began in pure mathematics, working in algebraic topology. Then around 2000, he became a pioneer of applied and computational topology and one of the founding figures of what's now known as topological data analysis, or TDA, helping to establish and shape the field that has transformed how topology is used to understand complex data. He continues to push into new frontiers. In recent years, he has become an important voice in topological deep learning, bringing ideas from topology to some of the central challenges in AI. So I have had the good fortune of knowing Professor Carlson for many years, and his vision of understanding the shape of data has deeply influenced my own research. But beyond his roles as a researcher and educator, Professor Carlson has also co-founded multiple companies, including Ayasti. So this is truly an extraordinary career, and I'm very excited to have this conversation with him today, to hear about Professor Carlson's journey, his experience moving between theory and practice, academia and industry, and his broader perspectives on the rapidly changing landscape of data science and AI. So Gunnar, welcome, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So I want to start with your journey. Mm-hmm. Okay, as I just mentioned, your career has followed a remarkable intellectual arc, you know, from pure to applied topology, from mathematics, data science, and AI, and from education to entrepreneurship. So when you look back, what are some of the questions that has always interested you? How do you view this journey, and you know, what have made the transitions?
First of all, what I'll say is that what drives it has always been the idea that pure math, pure mathematics, the things that we developed there in topology, complicated, you know, intricate things, should really be useful. Should be useful, and I think that that's what we've kind of ended up demonstrating with this. So, you know, the idea of algebraic topology itself, which is the study of shape, the mathematical study of shape, you know, appears to be entirely an abstract venture. Okay? But in fact, what you find is that shape is actually a way of organization, a way of organizing things, and so. Yes, it organizes spaces, but it also can organize data, and that is the whole ball of wax here, so to speak. That it's extremely useful. And by the way, I would say, was kind of led to that by their earlier experiences that other people had done before, which was to say, topology is very interesting, and it's applicable to number theory, which is a part of mathematics, you know, a wholly different part of mathematics. And it's very surprising that, in fact, it was applied there. And it was. And so my feeling was, we should apply algebraic topology and topology more generally everywhere where there's a need for organization and gaining understanding of phenomena.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, we're going to come to that, this shape of everything very soon, which is kind of behind the one of the important themes behind your work.
Yep.
But I'm wondering that through all of this transition, are there, you know, specific challenges that you encountered, as minds that you have to change, that have to really convince people that topology is this beautiful concept, not just abstract, that's really useful?
Both have come. Actually, the very first thing that happened, the challenge that you're mentioning, happened to me about a year or two into the process, when I ran into one of my old colleagues who's doing the pure algebraic topology alone. And he was very angry with me because he said, you're doing this stuff and it's going to take money away from being able to do regular topology, the pure topology. So
right.
So that happened. Mm-hmm. Now, but of course, the other that you mentioned, the idea of trying to convince people who don't know about topology
right.
that it's useful,
right.
that is the huge challenge, and it's come up in many different situations. And the one of the main things to say here is that in order to do that, what you need are examples.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you need to show them, and you need to show them how they could do it as well. You know, in other words, that we can build tools so that you can do this readily and easily. And that's an ongoing process, by the way. We need to make the subject such that happens.
Yeah. Right. Obviously, I think ultimately, in some sense, we have to really show them that how this can be useful and then make it also become easy tools.
That's right.
And that's also part of this computational aspect
that
come into picture, that you want this computable, you want them to be able to compute robustly and efficiently.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but another, I think, related question is that was this all of this come very naturally, or are there specific events or people, collaborator? Sometimes our trajectory is shaped by people who we work with, right? So are there such specific?
Well, I will say, yes, there are specific people, but the first one that comes to mind is actually my father.
Uh-huh.
So when I was five, or six maybe, Russia shot off a satellite called Sputnik.
Right.
And my father saw that this had been done, and he was very excited about it. And he said, and he's telling me, he said, you know what they needed to do this? They needed math. And so he told me that, and he said, you should do math. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's very motivating when you have someone saying that you should do something. You know, it's not a making a demand, it's kind of making motivation. Now, in terms of other people that have helped, I found talking to computer scientists very, very helpful because to understand how to transition the ideas from topology into something computational, when I myself had little to no experience in actual computation, I had to rely on people, such as Leo Gibas here at Stanford, but many others as well. And so that was really important. And also scientists in general, you know, what questions are they interested in? You know, early days, remember we talking to Vijay Pandey and understanding that protein folding was important, was an important
right.
question.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all those are all things that are motivating and that kind of help the process along.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah. I like that. I think this kind of have this broad perspective that bringing different ideas coming together has become more and more important, especially nowadays in data science and AI. You know, you see that mathematics, statistics, computation, and machine learning and domain sciences all come together. Okay. But I mean, there are just an infinite number of problems there to be solved. And so through this career, that how do you usually choose the problems and also applications. I mean, as you personally have done different applications, I mean, your early work on breast cancer, using the mapper to identify the structure behind, and in our, I think, RNA sequencing data, et cetera. Yeah.
So let me say that actually the answer is a little different depending on mm-hmm. what phase of the career
mm-hmm.
you're in. So in the very early days of the career, that main idea was to say, well, what are the famous topologists talking about? You know, I need to know what that is, and let me try to see if I can solve a problem like that. Okay, that's very, goal-oriented somehow. But
and intellectual, pure, like solving the problem at hand.
Definitely, but also, what I would also argue, and this is kind of what I've always wanted to encourage, is that mathematicians, as they get more mature, should not be tied to just the conjectures that others have made. People should be responsible for their own problems that they do. In other words, for the value of them. So, just in the pure math in any place that kind of applies. So then later it became harder, you know, when we were starting to do the applied work, it became harder to identify the problems. And so I kind of relied on, people I was working with. And then they were sort of sometimes postdocs, sometimes, postdoctoral researchers. And so, for example, you mentioned the breast cancer work. Well, I wouldn't have known about, you know, breast cancer and all the subtypes and so forth. But, you know, Monica Nicolau, who was working in the group, explained this all to me, how this worked and what the importance of it was. And so then over time, well, then I got to understand it a bit. And so now I've been doing more work here with people at UCSD on classifying breast cancer and so forth. But it requires something which mathematicians aren't always great at, which is that you need to be talking to people and communicating and understanding back and forth, even when there's some impedance on the communication, because they use a different language.
That's true, yeah. But I mean, in addition to this communication, understanding their problem, I think there's also that you must have some intuition that when you hear about those problems, that's okay, this family of problems probably more suitable for topology, for what I'm good at, and so on.
Yes, and I should say, and that ability to see what's useful and what's not is something that has developed over time for me. So the kind of the first instance of it was when I first got into TDA, mm-hmm. I was working on something called the Novikov or Borel conjectures, which is a conjecture in group theory and in sort of intricate geometry of manifolds. But somewhere in the middle of that, there was this construction called the Ripps complex, technical term. But that thing translated very nicely into the into the data side, I should say. And so, you know, if I had not been thinking about the geometric work beforehand, might not have occurred to me. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and there's lots of episodes like that going through the whole work. I mean, one thing was I remember representation theorists explaining about certain constructions that helped in developing tools for analyzing data. I'm thinking here of the various kinds of persistence, for example. So to see what they're doing. I think one of the main things is to just read broadly, to be curious and read broadly, like read expository things. You can't read all the technical stuff in everybody's domain. That's just, you know, life isn't that long. But what you can do is read the expository stuff and see, well, maybe this might work, maybe that might work.
Mm-hmm. Right. I also thought that, I mean, just to follow up with what you just said, that very often, I mean, by reading, we form some intuition. It's almost like a gradient of some unknown function. And that's when we see new problems, that intuition really helps us,
yep.
Right? We are following certain more likely directions and making the connections.
Well, not to get ahead of ourselves here, mm-hmm. but maybe we can get ahead
right.
of ourselves anyway. I'm experimenting a lot with Gemini and the other AI things, specifically as it relates to mathematics. And so now there's a lot of work on it, how it's being used to produce proofs, which is great, but I use it as a super duper search engine.
Right, and as a way to explore.
That's right. And so it acts as somebody who's read all the expository literature and some of the deep literature and is able to sort of give me that very much more quickly. So nowadays, if I had had this back then, it would have moved things along so much more rapidly.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to come back to this
relation
between AI and the math later. Yeah.
Right.
So then maybe let me just move on the research direction. One theme of your work I mentioned earlier that has always really resonated with me is this shape of data. In some sense that we humankind has always using mathematics as a tool for us to understand the world around us. And geometry and topology in particular provides the beautiful tools to understand structure, spaces, and shapes, right? And I think that your work, along with many others, has kind of really brought that into the world of data, What are the shape behind the data we see everywhere? What does that shape reveal? And more importantly, how can we then use that shape to help us to build better tools for data science or for AI?
Yeah.
So I just want to hear about your perspective. Yeah. What is shape of data to you? And why is this perspective so powerful?
It's powerful. I think the main reason is it's not so complicated. It is that maybe one of the main tasks in science is to divide things into groups. Mm-hmm. You know, diseases into groups that can be treated the same way, that have things in common, that have things that are in, and then that and things that distinguish those groups. And so one needs tools for enabling that. When you look at a large, complicated data set, there's no way that you can look in there and see, oh, here's the group, you know, here's this group, here's that group. I mean, you know, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, for example. I wouldn't see that necessarily. I mean, it took a long time for people to see back in the day. And now things are much more complicated. There are many more types. I find it's very analogous to the game Connections. I don't know if you know the game Connections.
Yes, yes.
In the New York Times.
Right.
Where what you're being asked for, you have an array of 16 things and you're supposed to find the groups. And I think it's a really good paradigm, or it's a good way to illustrate what it is that one is doing on other kinds of data, is to try to divide them into things and understand how they differ, how the groups differ, and how they are the same. Mm-hmm. What it is that makes them the same.
Mm-hmm. Right, that makes sense. On the other hand, I mean, just to play the advocate, I think that on the other hand, I mean, topology in particular, this is a very hard language for a lot of people, especially at the beginning, right? So I mean, how do you convince them? You already mentioned the three examples. I mean, that's one very powerful way, but how else can we help to, you know, make topological methods, for example, become more standard approach methods?
We need to take advantage of people's natural desire to play with things. Mm-hmm. So we need to give them tools, or toys that they can play with their own data. And I think that's a hard thing to do, because that's a question not just of the underlying science, but it's a question of sort of human behavior. Mm-hmm. And and what motivates people. But I think that's, frankly, the fundamental thing, to build more and more automatic tools that people can take their data, mm-hmm. put the data into the tool, mm-hmm. and that something
and
comes out.
And then
they'll find it won't always work as they think, but if it gives them something they can play with, then they can start to work with it and get motivated. So I think that's the challenge for us, is to build more and more of these automated mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, in some sense, for example, I think one of the reasons for the popularity of tools such as PCA is also because, I mean, it's very easily accessible.
Yes.
And then, but one thing of PCA is also that it's intuitively interpretable. Like, one can try to say what might be captured by the principal direction. So what do you think about this interpretability perspective of topological tools?
You see, I think that's where we ultimately have an advantage, because, you know, PCA, as you say, it sort of divides things up, but roughly speaking, it's like which feature is the most, carries the most information, and which one carries the next most, and so forth. But it doesn't always divide things up into groups where you can see what's going on, and it doesn't allow you to sort
there
of
more
play with an experiment.
There are more intricate structures, and
yeah, that's right. And so that's kind of what I think. I mean, I think that topology is really almost designed for finding groups. What you'll find is when you look at the subject of topology, the idea of coverings, that is to say, you know, collections of sets that cover the whole set, is such a key ingredient there. And so to find the right, what's the right covering with kind of overlaps, that's a really important thing.
So do you think that TDA tools can become part of the standard data analysis, data processing pipeline?
I think that they can. I think that I think we haven't paid enough attention yet to what I would call the user interface. That is to say, the building the tools or the toys that people can play with. But we should be doing that. And I'm sort of, whenever I talk to young people working on it, that's kind of what I'm suggesting
to them
is build things that people can work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So maybe let's like connect this a little bit also to the modern AI. We've all seen, you know, AI and machine learning the last few years has really shown remarkable capabilities. And so in some sense that I think the today's AI also take on this flavor of experimental physics, mm-hmm. that there are a lot of observations and some of the insights that really emerge from large scale experiments.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems to me that this actually provide even better platform, a playground mm-hmm. to explore geometric and topological tools. But I'm just wanting to hear your perspective on how geometry and topology, what are some of the areas you think this can have a bigger impact?
Well, I do think that the neural networks and so on, where people are already starting to study featurizations of those. They understand that the internal activations are, you know, are a little too complicated and noisy, and they need to understand, larger scale phenomena, supernodes, as Anthropic kind of calls them. Mm-hmm. I think that's the part of the reason why topology will be very important there. It can indicate also not just finding a single group decomposition, but finding two different ones and the relationship between them. So if you imagine the features at one layer of a neural net versus the features at another layer, how they relate to each other, that's very important as well.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Topology in some sense that one of the key is that it's actually really looking at the connectivity.
Yeah.
Look at the structures and not just the necessarily just cluster. You're looking at more this continuous structure, but yet causing it into a way that we can still, easily interpret and instead of very complex with all the details there. So I see. So this kind of naturally actually leads to my next question, which is a broader question about the role of mathematics in the modern age of AI. Mathematics, of course, has been one of the foundations for AI. But in recent years, we also see that AI can actually be used to help with mathematical discoveries, right? I mean, first we do this last year, we had the solving IMO, get gold medals, but then very soon we're using AI to produce new proofs and solving conjecture. And very recently, we're just talking about the solve this 80 years conjecture or this problem on the unique distances.
Yeah.
So what's your view on this two-way relation, this mathematics for AI and AI for mathematics?
I'm personally much more enthusiastic about about mathematics for AI.
Mm-hmm.
How and maybe have been a little skeptical about AI for mathematics.
Uh-huh.
But that skepticism is starting to break down. It's just seeing too much success going on there. So I think both are important. I mean, the reason I say that I like the math for AI better is that, well, I'd like to see mathematics make a contribution to society. And, the contributions to society that way can be broader than simply producing proofs of theorems, which is a very good endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But, really, I think there's larger immediate societal gains to be gotten from the math for AI.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I guess, from the perspective of the modern AI, I mentioned earlier that has this kind of experimental physics flavor, but we still need to understand the foundation, I guess.
Yeah.
From that perspective, I mean, that we still have a huge gap where mathematics can play a lot of.
No, I totally agree. So I believe that mathematics for AI is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been some thinking that people said for a while that, we don't need to understand it. We can just throw more compute and more more data.
Leave everything to scale.
I think there's problems with that. I think mm-hmm. the first is mm-hmm. that actually it isn't true that you can do that because, even if we believe that we can, build however many data centers to accomplish it, and fill up the state of Texas with data centers, even if we believe that there's not enough data around always to make that, and the data is very hard to collect, can be very hard to collect. So, for that reason, I sort of believe that it's important that we be able to guide these kind of methods. And I think you're seeing it now. The applications in industry, mm-hmm. when they're in any kind of regulated industries, it's much harder to get the AI adopted. You know, you need to have some understanding of what it's doing and how it's doing it.
You have to be able to interpret it
yeah.
to some extent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think there's also, I mean, this question of there very often the last mile is the hardest mile. It's kind of this kind of a long tail.
Yeah.
And to reach that, you probably cannot purely just reach by scale. You would have to have some fundamental understanding to reach the long tail.
And anyway, we want to sort of control the technology that we've got so that it's mm-hmm. for sure
so
for human benefit.
So we need to have an understanding.
Think we don't think we can necessarily count on that it'll do that by itself.
Fair point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah right.
So related to this, how do you think this would affect how we train the next generation of not just a mathematicians, data scientists, the AI researchers, and the practitioner, right? I mean, what kind of mathematical skill sets or computational skill sets that they should learn, what ways of thinking they should really develop. I think these are all.
Yeah. So particularly for the mathematicians, I particularly have, a point of view on that, which mm-hmm. is that mathematicians have tended to say, give me the mathematical problem and I'll solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't count on people to formulate the problems in exactly the terms that we want. So I just feel that it's very important for mathematicians to a certain extent to get involved in the formulation process mm-hmm. of the problems as well, because we really understand better than anyone what the methods can and cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that everybody needs to go and stop doing the theorem proving and start, doing, formulation, but just to kind of be aware of it and do some of it, I think is really important. As for others, I think it's very, if you're thinking about maybe computer scientists and so on and others, the idea to give them sort of a better understanding of how math applies to AI and to data and so on, so that it becomes real to them. So it's not somehow a theorem that was proved 2,000 years ago mm-hmm. or 1,000 years
right,
ago.
Right, right. It's kind of relevant to theory.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. There's, understand what the theory does so that then when they have a problem, they can say, maybe this works. Maybe I try it myself, maybe I go consult with my friend, the mathematician, and do something that way.
I think I have to ask you about your experience on entrepreneurship.
Oh, okay, yes.
As I mentioned, you co-founded several companies at Yasti, which really aims to bring, mathematical tools, topological data analysis, but now to real life, industry scale, data science, machine yeah. learning challenge in practice. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that through this whole, experience with multiple companies, there are lessons, maybe interesting stories that you're willing to share.
It's tempting to say, I'm going to build a tool for someone to use, and they're going to use it. Okay, so we can do that with our mathematical point of view and say, this is what the tool looks like. This is what I would like. But you actually need to go do some customer research in the generalized sense. You need to understand what do people actually do, what are they willing to do, to what extent are they willing to use tools, to what extent do things have to be completely automatic. And that is something that took a long time to learn.
Not what we're trained for either.
No, it's not what we're trained for. But I think that's fundamentally important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember we had the first company, we had a marketing product development person
mm-hmm.
who said, you should develop this as a group-centered user interface, where it produces the groups. Mm-hmm. And initially, I remember dismissing it, but over time, I realized that he was really onto something there, because that's a great thing to present to people, what are the groups? And then they can take the challenge and say, what's different between this group and that group and so on.
So, I mean, if you have to do this again, first, would you do it again? Second, is there anything that you're going to do differently?
Well, it's always more and more to this user-centered thing,
mm-hmm,
frankly. That mm-hmm. is the very important key thing here, is that you've got to have your user in mind. And you've got to understand them better and better. So that you can then take the math and kind of adapt it and steer it. That's, and I think that sort of applies to anybody who's in business, frankly, that you know, understanding your customer, that's the holy grail.
Since you have this perspective, both from the academia side and also startup culture, I'm curious, I mean, it's a challenging question, just your perspective on what is a healthy relationship between academia and industry in general, and what could each side contribute? And especially, I'm also asking this question because of what's the way that AI is developing, especially the reliance on scale, for example. I mean, there are certain things that become very hard to contribute from academic research perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But there, of course, there are many, in my view, that other valuable, unique things that academic research can contribute. So I'm curious to see what you see as a healthy relation.
I think one has to take certain things into account here. I mean, sometimes mathematicians and other academic researchers, they just want to do the problem that they want to do. Now, if that's a perfect fit for somebody, then I think it's a healthy relationship for the industry to fund that person. Mm-hmm. Usually, mm-hmm. I think that there's a bit of a mismatch. That is to say, industry knows that it needs and wants something. Mm-hmm. Mathematics knows that it can produce something, but it's not quite merged, and so I think it needs to merge. You know, maybe both sides need to understand each other better, and so that the industry people can say, hey, you know, you're doing this pure stuff, looks to me like it might do something useful, can you adapt it to work in this way? And on the other hand, you know, a mathematician or an academic researcher might also say, hey, you have a problem there, looks to me like this might solve it. Mm-hmm. Probably the communication between the two is fundamentally important.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I guess there's also this is similar to this exploration versus exploitation type. I mean, you can balance between how much we're going to just explore, which is very often academics are doing, and sometimes how do we use whatever explored and maybe just really use it for make predictions and so on, but how do you balance the two?
I'm not sure one needs to balance it, mm-hmm. as much as it is to make sure that there is some connection, mm-hmm. there. In other words, I think, mm-hmm. mentioned before,
make sure
that I think
it's not just a disjoint living in two.
So that mathematicians need to take to understand a little bit, mm-hmm. You know, of what's going on out there, because we can't expect everyone to formulate their problems in the terms that we understand, or that they are exactly what it is that we're trying to do. You know, it may be a modification, and so the more flexibility there can be on both sides, you know, for mathematicians and researchers to sort of understand what the problems of the real world are, and vice versa, that's what's kind of going to lead to really rapid advances, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at Telos, I mean, which is one of the NSF AI Institute, we have an annual industry day, which, yeah. part of the goal is exactly like this, to provide this platform, yeah. where the, you know, researcher from academia, from industry, practitioner come together, that we understand their pain, right. points, and they also see what's going on that produced within the by the students, especially also, this is also great for the young talents.
Yes.
You know, they get to see, hear, what's the real challenges over there?
I think you're doing a great thing there with that. It sounds wonderful. You know, at Stanford, we have programs that have a lot of industrial affiliates, and it's a little bit, you know, it's like once a year they come in and present and so on. And
right.
Maybe it should be a little more frequent and a little more, you know, informal also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any advice that you want to give to young researchers who might be interested in, or maybe not necessarily young people like us, who might be interested in building their own startups?
Yeah, make sure that you think through the business case first. There's a temptation to say, I have a great idea, I have a great tool, someone will figure out a way to use it. And the answer to that is, that's not how it works. You know, that's... maybe that'll work occasionally, but fundamentally, I would just, if I'm going to do a startup, I would definitely understand the potential customers and think hard about that, talk to whoever I can about that, and see if you can get some preliminary vetting on whether, you know, a concept that you have would be useful.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to ask you one last question.
Okay.
This is not really on the immediate research, more about broader intellectual influences.
Okay.
I'm wondering whether you have, are there any books, essays, you know, podcasts, blogs, anything that you read, I thought that really interesting that we'd like to recommend to our audience.
I'm going to just bring up the current things that come up for me, but I really like the blog posts from Anthropic on the general area of mechanistic interpretability,
which is a very important area.
Yep. I think it's fantastic. And that, and also Eric Ho at, Good Fire.
Mm-hmm.
I also just in general like the Less Wrong, that site, and Neil Nanda's thinking on this interpretability and other things as well. So those are a few that have really piqued
enjoyed
my fancy.
This is also interesting that we're starting to see this trend that now there are a lot of resources like this available online that's open to everyone.
Yes.
That we're gradually, spending more and more time and getting more and more insights from, blog posts like this or essays and articles. So it's a very interesting mode. It's in some sense a new mode. I mean, we had blogs before, but not to the extent that we are using nowadays.
It's completely different.
Yeah, because it's also fast pacing. So those often those are the probably most
it's the opposite of the academic paradigm, which is, or at least in mathematics, that you write a paper, it has to be bulletproof, completely perfectly right, and expect to have someone spend 2 years refereeing it before it gets out. And the modern world is more like, well, put something out there, just is it directionally correct? Probably if it's directionally correct, that's okay, and then someone will push back. And so there's sort of a much more of a back and forth, or
you can think
rapid
of this a larger scale of the conversation instead like we two here, but now you're through this new venues, blogs and so on, have a
kind of like rapid prototyping.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Gunnar. I mean, thank you very much.
Well,
I mean,
thank
this
you.
Has been such a wonderful conversation.
This is great.
I also want to add that I've always admired your work since my PhD years, as I mentioned. I mean, this has influenced my own research. So it's very special for me to have this conversation with
you. You're very kind. You're very kind. And I actually have a lot of admiration for your work as well. So
thank you. Thank you. So thank you for sharing your time, your wisdom, and your insights with us today. And I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk like this again in the future.
I agree. It was wonderful talking to you, Yusu. I really enjoyed it.